dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The problems of the economy and the legislation designed to address those problems is the top story of the day. In spite of the discussion being widespread, its range is narrow, confined to the premise of whether the government has the correct strategy to restore the economy, not whether that economy was workable or desirable, or whether there are other options for the economic life of a society that would not lead to a variety of chronic, cyclical, as well as acute harms. This week on the program, I'm going to bring you analysis from an international range of guests, from a perspective not generally available, the anti-capitalist perspective. It's from a series, Capitalism and Its Discontents, produced for Pacifica Radio by Eric Klein, Eddie Yuen, Ramsey Kanan, and Sasha Lilly. Yes, for you AK Press readers, he's that, Ramsey. The program was produced in the second week of February, so some references to events will be 2 weeks behind, so don't be confused by that. The information, however, remains absolutely timely.
I just want my fortune now. I don't care where or when or how. I don't want the dustbin or the cuddly toy. I'm going for the jackpot, boy, oh boy, oh boy.
I'm Sasha Lilly. Britain has been hard hit by the economic crisis, which the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Alistair Darling, has admitted is the worst in 60 years. 2 weeks ago, oil refinery workers in England, Scotland, and Wales went on strike without the sanctioning of their unions over the exclusion of British workers from construction contracts and won all their demands. Ramsey Kanan spoke with Ian Bone, co-founder of the organization Class War, about the slump and the specter of a new era of labor militancy in the UK.
Ian, can you talk a little about the cause and scope of the current economic crisis as it's happening in the UK?
Yeah, I mean, basically, people are blaming the bankers. The bankers are extremely unpopular. The feeling is now that the bankers are being bailed out, as in the US, that the bankers are still getting their bonuses. They're continuing with their rich lifestyles. And the people who are blameless, the victims of the banking crisis, the workers, are suffering the effects of the recession being laid off. So you've got, you know, Gordon Brown had promised an end to boom and bust. Well, that's not quite true. So the people are suffering at the sharp end now. High street chain shops are closing all over the place. Workers who never, you know, thought that their job security would be in question are being laid off and made redundant. It's coming a big shock to the system.
Do you think that beyond blaming the bankers, what do you think are the causes, particularly in the UK, of this recession?
Well, so, you know, in straightforward capitalist economic terms, we suffered from the investment of our banks in your subprime debts over there. People have borrowed too much money at high interest rates. People have been encouraged to take mortgages with 100% mortgages with deposits of about £5,000, thinking that house prices would steadily go on rising. A house, rather than being something to live in, was an investment, and things would never go wrong.
What other responses have been bubbling up? What have we actually seen happening? I mean, obviously in other countries, in Iceland, you've seen riots in the streets and effigies being burnt. What has been the response in the UK?
Yeah, we've been acutely aware of what's happening around the rest of Europe, but the sort of eruptions in Greece a few months ago, but which were more a result of the police killing one individual. But lately, the riots in Latvia, Lithuania, Iceland, Bulgaria have been just by people whose noses are up against the wall, by poor, hard-pressed people who don't know where to turn to. And so far, until a few weeks ago, the situation in Britain was very much moan, whinge, blame, but not much sign of anger. But then about 2 weeks ago, a group of oil refinery workers who'd been laid off and migrant labour had been shipped in from Italy and Portugal to take their places. And it turned out, in fact, that the British trade unions couldn't even apply for the jobs in the first place. So, as you probably know, there's loads of anti-union laws in Britain. There hasn't been such a thing as a wildcat strike for about 15 years. So a series of wildcat strikes hit this oil refinery construction site, and oil refinery construction workers all over England, Scotland and Wales walked out in solidarity, all on strictly illegal wildcat strikes. And the strike was a mix of things. It wasn't a pure, a pure class struggle. All sorts of mixed emotions were built up in it. But basically, the government was thrown onto the back foot, and the strikers have won all their demands. And it's the first time that any sort of trade union action, although this is obviously unofficial trade union action, has emboldened people. And I think on the back of that, we're going to see a lot more industrial unrest, which there hasn't been in Britain since the mid-80s in 1985, because the unions have been cowed. So that's a really big, significant development here.
And how does that play into the discourse, for want of a better term, that's going on the left? I mean, certainly in the last, you mentioned 1985, which was the end, if you like, of labour unrest in the Thatcher years, culminating with the miners' strike in 1984-85. That saw, from the capitalist point of view, as you said, the destruction of organised labour, of the trade unions and of organised working class resistance. Has this new success in the construction trades, has that emboldened the left?
Yeah, I mean, I think this, again, the unions, the trade unions themselves were running behind the workers, and they couldn't denounce the wildcat because workers were working, walking out all over the country. So they tried to sort of mediate the demands of the wildcat strikers. But there was a really good network of unofficial shop stewards committees, and it was odd because the one area in Britain where workers are still pretty unionised, apart from the railways, is construction sites. And there's always been a whole history of militant, sort of almost underground shop stewards networks organising on the job, organising for, for get wage increases at different plants and so on. And that's come to the fore again. There's been a really good unofficial shop stewards committee which has sort of negotiated the strike to complete victory. Now, other workers are being made redundant. There's at the moment in Ireland, there's a sit-in going on at Waterford's Crystal Glass factory where workers have taken over the factory for the last week. I wouldn't rule out seeing in Britain in the next couple of months the next big wave of redundancies. I wouldn't at all rule out seeing some factory occupations. It feels a bit now like there's the lid's waiting to blow, the kettle's bobbing up and down. It won't take much to get people out. A lot, back out on the streets. A lot of the workers, I think, even when they won their demands, weren't too keen to go back to work. They fancied marching on the House of Commons, blocking roads with tractors and all that kind of stuff. So I think it's going to be a very exciting couple of months. And, the English working class, as you say, has been cowed since 1985. I think things are on the change.
So would you think then that, I mean, not only was the working class cowed and beaten about and got very bloodied, but also the myth, shall we say, perpetrated by the Tony Blair government of Cool Britannia was almost perhaps borrowed from this America thing that everyone is classless and we're all middle class and everything is great and we're all one nation under God. Do you think that this is putting class back on the agenda and struggle back on the agenda in Britain?
I think it is. I mean, I think people did buy into that. And, while the sort of economy was booming, then it was quite good to buy into that. And people were owning their own houses and they'd achieved, going back two generations to own your own house. Was a fantastic thing to want to achieve, and you could swap jobs, with plenty of jobs would go, and you could make a fortune out of selling your house and then buy another one. So there was this dream of a sort of, and all these articles, the end of politics, the end of class society, and so on. So that seemed a convincing narrative until the recession came along, and now everything's up for grabs. I don't think you can say what you can see at the moment is not class consciousness; it's individuals individual groups of workers or individuals not buying into that myth anymore. That's not generalised into a general class consciousness. It's just patchy, it's bitty sections of workers. It's far away from that yet. But things can change very quickly indeed.
And you've obviously been an agitator, a troublemaker, a fixture on the scene in the UK for 4 decades now, perhaps. You're, as the co-founder of an organisation called Class War, you're obviously particularly partisan. From your point of view, what would you like to see more of? How would you like to see this opposition to capital manifesting itself in the UK?
I think we've got a big opportunity coming up in England because we've got the G20 summit here of world leaders on April the 1st. I think it's Obama's first venture abroad. So we're going to have Putin, Obama, the whole lot here. And basically, they're going to be talking about how to deal with the recession. And I think if what the aim politically would be is to try and tie up the activist politics of Europe, you know, the activists, the anarchists from Greece, from Hamburg, from Berlin, the obvious places, tie up with the people, the rioters from Iceland to Lithuania to Latvia. So there's a huge march being organised the week before, sort of, you know, people's Europe versus the bankers' Europe. And normally these just concerned are the usual tired activists and NGOs, but this time I think it's going to really touch a nerve right across Europe. And I think there's going to be tens of thousands of people coming over. And if you know, some of the wildcat strikers from the oil refineries and Waterford Crystal and other factory occupations that come on, that's going to be a significantly different kettle of fish than opposition to other summits has been, where it's just been a few activists, you know, from Seattle to wherever. So this offers a chance of qualitatively stepping forward. If then people go home from that and see there is some power, there is another version of Europe which isn't run by the bankers, which is, you know, the people's Europe, then I think we might see some unified struggles all over Europe, which would be, you know, very exciting.
And that was Ian Bone, co-founder of the organization Class War and the author of Bash the Rich, speaking with Ramsey Canan. You're listening to Capitalism and Its Discontents, a Pacifica special 5-part series on the global economic meltdown. I'm Sasha Lilly. The International Monetary Fund stated last year that the U.S. is experiencing its worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. All 5 of Wall Street's investment banks have now disappeared, along with more than 250,000 jobs in the U.S. financial services industry. Worldwide, over the past year, stock markets have dropped by 50%. Yet York University political scientist David McNally argues that the crisis is based not simply on the fallout from an unregulated financial sector run amok, but on the long-standing structural dynamics built into capitalism itself. When I spoke with him, I asked McNally to lay out the scope of the crisis.
Well, I think it's the scope that really, in the first instance, makes it so unique insofar as we've seen a whole series of regional crises across the last couple of decades, some of the most dramatic ones, of course, being the East Asian crisis of 1997, which just hammered into the ground Thailand, Indonesia, South Korea, the Philippines, Malaysia, and then, of course, the crisis in Argentina in 2000-2001, where we had literally the meltdown of a financial system, huge unemployment rates of 25-30%, shutdown of industry, and so on. So it's those sorts of crises have been par for the course for quite some time. But what's distinctive today is that this crisis could not be regionally contained. It began quite clearly in the U.S. economy in the summer of 2007. But since then, it has gone global in the fullest sense of the word. And it's interesting even to watch the sort of chain reaction first geographically as the financial crisis spreads from the U.S. to Europe to Japan to other parts of East Asia. But also, of course, the movement out of the financial sector, where really now, as I have argued, we're into phase two, which is that stage of the crisis in which major manufacturing corporations start to shut down plants, lay off tens of thousands of people, restructure, merge, or in some cases, before this is over, I'm convinced, we'll go right out of business. So we've got this scope is both system-wide in terms of the economy, that is to say it's gone from the financial sector into manufacturing and now services, and it's also gone global in a really meaningful sense. So that makes it unlike anything we've seen in a quarter century.
And while we hear a lot about how this crisis is affecting people in North America, in Europe, how about the Global South, and particularly the center in some ways, or one of the key centers of manufacturing worldwide, China?
Yeah, I think we're just beginning to see the effects on China. But people need to remember there was a lot of nonsense about how China and India and so on could be decoupled from a crisis in the U.S. economy and then more generally in the Western economies. But of course, these booms that we've seen in India and China have been built on the back of export drives to the West. And so as markets in the U.S. and Europe and Japan start to contract, those export industries are going to be hammered. And if we take the case of China, while reliable statistics are hard to come by, there seems to be a consensus emerging now that something over 25 million rural migrants have been forced to flee the cities and return to the countryside, which means they are effectively unemployed. They left the countryside because there was no work. They migrated to the cities during the expansion, and now they're being shed. They're the most vulnerable, and they're the first hurt inside the Chinese economy. Thousands upon thousands of plants have shut. And I think in some ways what might be the most dramatic figure is to recognize that sitting in warehouses in China today, we've got 3 years' worth of global demand for refrigerators. In other words,
incredible.
Yeah, all the fridges that could be bought in three sort of normal years in the economy are just sitting there. That means factories are just shutting their doors and not producing any more of them. So I think we've just seen the first wave of the crisis is hitting China. And of course, as it hits China, it just ripples through the whole of East Asia.
Well, on the left, this crisis tends to be explained in two ways. One focuses on the deregulation of financial markets over the past three decades, which has allowed for wild speculation and the incredible proliferation of financial transactions and therefore led to great instability. The other argument is one about a long-term crisis of profitability that started in the 1970s and has been postponed until the present by injections of credit into the system. I wonder if you could flesh out for us these two arguments, and then tell us why you don't agree with either one.
Yes. Well, the regulation and deregulation argument, I think, is the weaker of the two, although, I have my own disagreements with both. But the problem with that argument is that it says, okay, there's not really a systemic fault line here. It's simply a series of neoliberal policies which were introduced, which allowed first the commercial banks and then investment banks and other sorts of shadow banks like hedge funds and so on to run wild. They could do whatever they wanted. They took on exorbitant amounts of debt. They made absurd loans and so on. And if we can just put the genie back in the bottle, we could re-regulate and get rid of financial crises like this. And I've got a couple of problems with this argument. The first is that when I look at it, it seems to me that the evidence is compelling that the deregulation of financial services really followed structural transformations within the world capitalist economy. In other words, as capital went global, particularly in the form of the multinational corporation, it encouraged the growth of lending institutions which could operate outside national boundaries in the so-called offshore banking system. And as a result, whether it was called the Eurodollar market or whether we were talking about the small banks that could do huge amounts of business in places like the Cayman Islands and so on, we got a financial system that was responding to a much more internationalized production system. And as a result, markets, financial markets like the U.S. and the U.K. were losing a lot of business. The banks were losing a lot of that lending business because these offshore banks were doing it. Sooner or later, they pressed to have liberalization and deregulation, which would let them get into some of these financial operations that they've been excluded from. But what I'm tracing for you here is a process by which first comes really the great global reorganization of manufacturing industries through the multinational corporation. Then come forms of financing that fit that new world economy. And then comes the deregulation in the major centers. So to imagine that somehow you could wind it all back is to literally imagine that all of a sudden you could have capitalist economies which were predominantly national again, not based on multinational production and the financial arrangements that go with it. So I think that the problem for the people who emphasize deregulation is that they're unable really to properly account for these changes. They're not just policy changes by particularly evil characters in government, although frankly, I think they are quite evil characters in government, but the truth is they were responding to structural changes. Now, the other approach at least has the merit of saying, well, we need to look at great developments in the whole process of capitalist expansion, the accumulation of new production facilities, new plants and mines and factories, offices and so on, and we need to look at where corporate profitability is. And I think that the great strength of that is at least they're looking at those kinds of phenomena and not just focusing on the financial sector. But I think the problem is that there's been a tendency in a lot of that argument to look just at two or three of the major capitalistically developed economies in the North. The typical frame of reference is to look at the U.S., the German, and the Japanese economies, and then to show that profit rates started to come down at the late 1960s, and so on. Well, that's all true. But to me, that ignores two really crucial transformations that happen. I have no doubt that the rate of profit on for all corporations was falling from the late 1960s into the early 1980s. But I see, on the one hand, the impact of the two great world recessions, 1974-75, 1980-82, and the neoliberal offensive against labor in the North and against the global South generally.
And can you just explain that word, yes, neoliberal?
Yeah, when I say neoliberal, what I'm really talking about is that package of policies. We see that really, if you were going to sort of date it, we're talking about the transformations that begin in China in 1978 that accompany the election of Margaret Thatcher in Britain in 1979 and Ronald Reagan in the U.S. in 1980, where they, under the banner of rolling back socialism and the welfare state and letting markets reign supreme again, they cut back social service spending dramatically. They privatize state-run utilities, industries, and so on. The British case, of course, the battle over the coal mines is crucial. They go right on the offensive to confront unions and try to roll back the power of unions, the wage levels that workers in the North can command, and so on. So that's the first side of the neoliberal agenda. The second is the attempt to really impose enormous hardship on the global South, to use the debt crisis, which comes to a head with the recession of 1980 to 82, to use that debt crisis to go in and essentially rewrite the rules of the game in the global South through structural adjustment programs orchestrated by the International Monetary Fund and to some degree the World Bank, where they literally go and they say, okay, you have $450 million in debts that you cannot pay in your tiny little economy. Well, guess what? You can have new loans that will allow you to make your payments. We'll lend you more money, but you're going to have to do all the things that I've just described, except that the cuts are much worse. They must lay off 20% of all public employees. They must get rid of any subsidies for fuel and food for the poor. They must massively privatize. They must open up their financial industries so that Western banks can come in and basically gobble them up and so on. That offensive against labor in the North and against the peoples of the global South generally, I think did lay the basis for a new wave of capitalist expansion. Essentially, they had made it more profitable because they boosted profits by cannibalizing the South on the one hand and driving down wages in the North on the other. And then they began to relocate production facilities into low-wage zones of the South. And all of that does produce a quite considerable period of expansion from at least 1982, the end of the last global recession, until the East Asian crisis of 1997. This is the period in which you see enormous development of manufacturing industry in a number of these sorts of countries that I've already mentioned, South Korea, China, Indonesia, Malaysia, Taiwan, and so on. That becomes the center, really, East Asia, of a whole process of global capitalist expansion. And you can see it in the profitability rates. The profits do start to rise once again quite systematically from the early 1980s onwards for corporations in Japan, U.S., Europe, and so on. So the problem with saying, well, it's just there's a crisis that begins in the 1970s, and we just get out of it, or we don't get out of it. We stumble through it through credit expansion, through just the injection of large amounts of debt into the world economy. The problem with that argument for me is twofold. First, it ignores the very real material effects of what I'm calling this neoliberal offensive against workers in the North and the people of the global South generally, and the way in which that does boost corporate profitability. It does enable enormous restructuring, particularly of manufacturing industries throughout the world and much of it happening in East Asia. And as a result, it ignores, I think, really some of the most dramatic global transformations. There's a tendency still for a lot of commentators on the left to think about capitalism as North America and Western Europe and not to take seriously the way in which the most dynamic centers of growth within the global capitalist system have been outside those traditional cores and have in particular been in East Asia.
You're listening to Capitalism and Its Discontents, a special series on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and my guest is David McNally. He teaches political science at York University in Toronto, where he joins me by phone, and is the author of a number of books, including Another World is Possible, Globalization and Anti-Capitalism. You were just laying out for us, David, the argument on the left of a crisis of profitability that was basically a hangover from the 1970s, and you were explaining why you didn't think this was the case in terms of this neoliberal offensive and the increase in profitability. So if we can't explain the crisis by looking at it as a long-standing crisis, how should we understand the roots of this crisis?
Well, I think what we need to do is then, if I'm right, and I think the evidence does support the argument that from about 1982 to 1997, we see a global expansion of capitalism again. It's not a crisis. It is a global expansion, and while it's centered in terms of manufacturing industries in East Asia, it's producing significant rates of growth. Doesn't mean there are no recessions, but it means that overall the system is expanding. But, of course, the nature of capitalism is that expansion happens in a competitive context. And by that I mean you have multiple manufacturers of automobiles, cell phones, computers, LCD TVs, whatever it might be, cameras, and they are all trying to get their product to market with the best quality at the lowest price. And this means that they're constantly having to find new technologies which will give them a slight edge on the competition. If they can produce the same good with slightly less labor, with slightly lower costs, they can then get into the market, they can undersell their competitors, they can hold or expand their market share, and so on. And what this means is that there's a frantic drive by all of these corporations and all those sorts of sectors and many, many others to keep building new capacities, to create new state-of-the-art factories, to retool them regularly with the latest computerized production systems, and so on. But as they do this, they produce much more capacity for the production of that good, let's say it's cell phones or cars, then in fact can be justified by the existing market demand. And in the jargon, this is known as a problem of overaccumulation, which is to say they've accumulated too many factories, too much machinery, and so on, relative to what they can actually sell. And that's the inevitable result of a long period of expansion. So just like the expansion at the end of the Second World War that begins to pick up around 1946, 47, 48, and then really runs for 20 or 25 years into the late 60s or early 70s before we get a global crisis again in the early 70s. Similarly, this expansion does begin to run out of steam by about 1997, and I don't think it's an accident that as you get this problem of overaccumulation, profits start to turn down again. So it is true that there's a crisis of profitability. It's just that it's been much more dynamic than simply one crisis since the 1970s. There was a 1970s crisis, then a big, what I'm calling neoliberal expansion, 82 to 97, then the East Asian crisis, which tells us, okay, they have in fact built too much productive capacity relative to what the capitalist market can absorb. There are factories that simply cannot operate profitably. At that point, it is true that credit expansion does start to intervene. It's haltingly at first, but then it's big time from about 2000 and 2001 on, particularly after Greenspan in the U.S., the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank, Alan Greenspan, massively drives down the rate of interest in the U.S. after 9/11, when they're worried that fear and panic will create a global recession.
You make the argument that in the past decades, the financialization, so to speak, of the economy has been one of the characteristic elements of neoliberalism and has fed in a tremendous way to ratcheting up this crisis of accumulation. Can you just back up and tell us historically what happened and explain the importance of financialization?
Yes, you're right, because it is really important. And as I see it, there are several elements involved here. When we talk about financialization, all we're saying really is that a larger and larger share of the production of goods and services and the profits made from the production of goods and services is staying in the hands of the financial sector. The financial sector represents more jobs within the economy. It represents a much higher share of profits. In fact, the share of profits of the financial sector rose from about 10% of total profits 30-some-odd years ago to 40% in the last few years. Financialization really means that their financial transactions are becoming more and more prominent in everyday life, and that they are becoming more and more lucrative or more and more profitable. Now, the roots of that for me go back really to when U.S. President Nixon took the American economy off gold convertibility with the dollar. Let me put it this way. If you had an old U.S. dollar from 1971 or before, it would actually have said on it, "We'll pay to the bearer on demand 1/35th of an ounce of gold." And what this meant was that the U.S. dollar was legally convertible for gold. I could take 35 of them, and if I was a central bank somewhere at least, I could get an ounce of gold for that. And that provided a very serious pillar of stability to the whole global economy. But as the U.S. was losing market share, becoming more dependent upon imports from other countries, as it began to develop trade deficits in the late 1960s, it became harder and harder to keep that convertibility of dollars for gold, because, in fact, foreign central banks did start to cash in their dollars, and there was a huge drain on gold out of the U.S. So when U.S. President Nixon suspends that convertibility, he says, you can no longer get gold for dollars. At that point, the whole world monetary system became enormously unstable. What's a dollar really worth? Moreover, what is any currency worth? Because most currencies were pegged to the dollar, the Canadian dollar, for example, but this would also have been true of the Japanese yen or the German mark or what have you, the French franc. They had all been tied to the exchange rate of the dollar, which was in turn tied to gold. Well, this was a field day for speculators. They could now start to speculate as to what the value of a given currency was. They could drive them up or down by betting one way or another. And this made it incredibly difficult for businesses to operate. And so businesses began to demand certain kind of protection from the enormous volatility of currencies. To give you an example, a German corporation could make a profit in U.S. dollars on its manufacturing plants, let's say, in the U.S. But then when it shipped those profits home, it might have taken a loss if the dollar had massively fallen. In other words, the book value at the head office in Frankfurt was a loss. And what that meant was that they were very worried about this kind of monetary instability. One answer to this was to start to create contracts which would allow you to buy a currency at a certain rate or sell it at a certain rate. And that's why currency trading just exploded in the 1970s. And I won't take you through all the ins and outs of it, but this is really where so-called derivative markets also explode. Now people are essentially trying to hedge risk of a currency rising or falling by getting somebody to agree that they will buy somebody's dollars at a certain rate or sell them dollars or yen or whatever at a certain rate. And there was enormous profits to be made and also big losses to be made there. But this was a field day for speculators. This was a field day for people who wanted to buy and sell currencies. It was a field day for people who wanted to sell so-called derivatives contracts, which were essentially options to buy or sell a given currency. And so the trading in all of this stuff, all these currencies and all these contracts designed to hedge the risk of currencies rising or falling, just proliferated. And that's the big structural underpinning of financialization. Then you add to that the expansion of all the other kinds of debt we've been talking about, from mortgages to credit cards to financial borrowing by banks and, of course, corporate borrowing and so on, and you get a situation where more and more transactions which are happening in the economy are really paper transactions. They're just about buying and selling currencies, stocks, bonds, loans, mortgages, credit card debt, and so on. And so that's what creates this financialization. And as I say, it does mean enormous profits flowed into that sector. But a lot of that is speculative. A lot of these profits are gained by betting on the movement of one thing or another. But if a point comes where investors out there become suspicious of buying all of these exotic sounding financial instruments, if for whatever reason they lose confidence in their viability, then the whole system's in trouble. And of course, they can lose confidence really, really quickly if a few big institutions make bad bets and they collapse. Then the question is, well, who should you buy financial instruments from? Maybe you're going to be in a situation where you've in fact bought junk. And when that happens, markets seize up. And really, since the summer of 2007, what's happened is that as the first hedge funds started to go down, then the Wall Street investment banks went down last year, more and more investors said, I don't want to touch this stuff. It's toxic. It's going to blow up in my face. And when they don't want to touch it, that means banks are left holding all these so-called assets, which are in fact falling in value on the market.
That's the voice of David McNally. He is an activist in global justice, socialist, and popular education movements in Toronto. He teaches political science at York University and is the author of a number of books, including Another World is Possible. So going back to the fact that the roots, at least, of the financialization of this crisis date back to Nixon's delinking the dollar from the gold standard in the early 1970s. Tell us about the role of the dollar now, particularly as you're talking about the crisis in some ways of quantifying value. And then on top of that, you have a situation with the dollar, which has put it under enormous pressure as the kind of default secure currency for the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question, because I think medium term, this is going to be a hugely important issue. It doesn't look it right now for reasons that I'll explain. But as you say, if we look at a situation where in 1971 the U.S. president says you can no longer get gold for dollars, then that raises a really important question. Well, why should economies the world over use the dollar as their international reserve currency? After all, if they accumulate huge reserves of it and they can't cash it in for gold, what are they going to do with it? And this was played out with really a lot of struggle between particularly the Europeans and the Americans in the early 1970s, because there was a push by the Europeans to move towards some alternative currency, perhaps something floated by the International Monetary Fund or that sort of thing. Through a combination of bullying and as a result of being able to make sure that the oil-producing countries kept pricing oil in dollars, as the value or the prices of oil exploded in the early 1970s, it became clear that so long as oil was priced in dollars, most countries were that import oil, therefore they're going to need dollars. So the U.S. dollar hung on as the main international reserve currency, that is to say the currency that most countries will use between one another. After all, if Brazil and Thailand are doing trade, the odds are when they settle up accounts, they don't want one another's currencies, but they're happy to take dollars. And so the dollar operates as that international currency that most countries are prepared to use and most banks and corporations are happy to use. And the other thing is that there really wasn't a viable alternative to it. Now, I think that in the last decade, we've seen the emergence of a potential alternative currency, and that's the euro. The European Union is about the same size, population, and economic wise as is the U.S. economy. Its currency has done very, very well. So, in fact, what we've seen is a slow drift away from the dollar and towards the euro, as if a lot of nations and a lot of corporations out there think, well, you know, in case the dollar is going to go down, why don't we at least start instead to accumulate both the euro and the dollar? Now, in the midst of this crisis, there has been a flight back to the dollar, just as there's been a flight to gold, in part because investors are so frightened by the turmoil. They figure that, well, the U.S. government, the American Treasury, is not going to go broke, at least. So if I just go and buy Treasury bonds and Treasury bills from the U.S., at least I know my money's safe. And they feel so uncertain about the safety of most of the global financial system that they've poured back into dollars. But long term, or even medium term, I don't think that's going to be the case. You look at the huge injections. I mean, when I say injections of money, the bailout costs in the U.S. are about $5 trillion so far. Most of that's been accomplished simply by printing money. And that's the reality, is that the Federal Reserve Bank and the U.S. Treasury have been in an agreement that they will print as much money as necessary to keep the banking system afloat. But that ultimately is money that's going to flow back into the hands of investors the world over, particularly central banks in countries like China and Japan and South Korea. And I'm not convinced that long term, as they look at these huge deficits, both the trade deficits and the budget deficits in the U.S., that they're going to feel enormously secure about that. My own prediction, therefore, would be that whenever we start to come out of the worst of this crisis, that the U.S. dollar will probably start to fall in value again. And while that can be a good thing for U.S. exporters, because it makes their goods less expensive elsewhere, it's not a good thing for the financial sector in the U.S., because, of course, it means that more and more transactions are going through other currencies and not through U.S. dollars. So I don't think the longer-term prognosis is good for the dollar, even though I don't expect it to be replaced in short order. You can see it already in these speeches that have happened at the Davos Forum, where both the Russian and Chinese presidents were more or less saying, we have to move away from a dollar-denominated, dollar- and dollar-dominated global economy. And I think that that's going to be an ongoing trend. The other side of it, of course, is the American model of capitalism has been discredited in this crisis. And I think that's not going to help the financial sector and the dollar either.
Well, what would the falling dollar and this crisis in general, what do you think it means for the power of the United States as an empire? And let me just throw another question in there. What role does war play in capitalist crises? Because obviously the U.S. has extended itself all over the world as an occupying power.
Let me start with empire and then go back to war. I think long term, this cannot be good for American imperial power. And frankly, that's not something that bothers me. I'm quite happy to see the U.S. empire less powerful around the world. But having said that, nevertheless, if we're just going to analyze the trends, I think it's a weakening trend for the U.S. I mean, you're dealing here with an economy that was already running a current account deficit equal to about 6% of gross domestic product. In other words, it was buying from the rest of the world massively more than it could sell to the rest of the world, and it was just shipping out dollars to cover that. That's okay so long as the rest of the world thinks those dollars are good. But if they get nervous about dollars and they start to dump them because they really don't want to keep holding on to billions and literally in some cases trillions of them, then that's going to push the U.S. Currency down. That is going to have lots of problems when you want to carry on major military operations in other parts of the world, because they literally become more expensive when you've got to do business in local currencies in Afghanistan or Iraq, when you're running military bases and so on. It also means that the huge deficits on the government side that are being run up under the bailout program under Hank Paulson, and now, of course, the Obama stimulus package, all of this is going to enormously expand U.S. government budget deficits. And that, too, is essentially covered by paper, by the printing of U.S. dollars. And so that's going to be a double pressure where I think investors are going to doubt the viability of the dollar. And so for the United States, this economic crisis comes in the context of the real military debacle in Iraq and the fact, I mean, every serious report, and Obama has more or less said as much, acknowledges that the Western forces, which are predominantly U.S., but Canada has a few thousand troops in Afghanistan, that they are losing ground right now, that they are completely failing in the Afghan mission. So Obama thinks he can just simply move troops, more or less, from Iraq to Afghanistan. But all of this is going to come with serious long-term costs. Afghanistan is going, if they are serious about what they want to do, you're talking about perhaps a couple of decades of the U.S. having to operate with, they're talking about troop levels now of 60,000. That probably won't be enough for what they want to carry off in Afghanistan. These costs on the American economy are going to be really dramatic, and this is going to raise awfully big questions about the trillions of dollars that are going into military expenditure and bailing out an ailing financial system that could otherwise be going into healthcare, social housing, and so on. And I think that's going to be the really key political debate coming of it. So I see the U.S. empire as developing less capacity to intervene whenever and wherever it wants as a result of some of the costs of this crisis. And I also suspect that the domestic debate about if we're going to spend trillions, where should they be spent, is likely to increase over the next couple of years.
You write in your piece, From Financial Crisis to World Slump, that, quote, crises are moments in which the subordination of labor to capital must be reorganized, in which new spaces of resistance can be pried open. Tell us what you mean by this.
Yeah. A crisis, you see, we often think of it as just a crisis in terms of some economic statistics. But I think it's much more than that. It is really a crisis for the very structures of capitalism. And when that happens, it means that things that people take for granted most of the time become subject of discussion and debate. Lots of examples can illustrate this, but take the recent occupation of a factory in Chicago at Republic Windows and Doors. There you have a situation where a tactic that has not been used by working class people in the United States since the Depression of the 1930s all of a sudden becomes a mobilizing tactic when a factory is shutting its doors without honoring its financial obligations to its employees, their severance pay and back pay packages and so on. Nevertheless, despite the fact that one of their major owners, the Bank of America, had been at the public trough getting a bailout. I think these crises where all of a sudden job security is up for grabs, plant shutdowns are the order of the day, the economy is being stimulated by massive government spending, that of course exposes the idea that free markets are the answer to everything and anything. That raises so many social questions that normally don't get addressed. In other words, as I say, for years and years and years, the refrain of the so-called neoliberals, their claim was you've got to run balanced budgets. Now, of course, they didn't do it, but that was the claim. Fiscal prudence, cut taxes, rely on the market, and so on. That whole ideology is melting down, and all of a sudden we discover that they can find trillions of dollars that they claimed not to have had in the past. They, moreover, can give the Bank of America lots of money while it's involved in an operation that's closing a plant, throwing workers out on the street, and not even giving them their severance pay. So I think moments like this produce very profound contradictions for just the everyday reproduction of the assumptions we have about capitalism and how it works. And people start to raise questions they don't normally raise, and even to act in ways like occupying a plant that they wouldn't normally. On a larger global scale, we can see it in, I think, a whole wave of developments. Think on the one hand of the riots and general strikes in December in Greece, which although commentators in North America didn't pay a lot of attention to it, people in Greece on the ground were saying over and over again, yes, the shooting of this 15-year-old ignited it, but what sustained this protest movement for weeks was hatred for the right-wing governments dealing with this crisis, its privatization program, its cutback on education and healthcare spending, and so on. And so the killing of a young person became really the spark for weeks and weeks of massive social protest. Or the government in Iceland, which fell last week after agreeing to a deal with the International Monetary Fund, and groups within civil society started to organize protests every week, every Tuesday night, outside the parliament buildings. Eventually, they started to do it every night. There was fighting with the police and demonstrations, and eventually the right-wing government in Iceland had to resign and collapsed last week. So that's the pattern. And, of course, last week also, a big general strike and demonstrations between 1 and 2 million in France over how the government is dealing with the crisis. I see this as a moment of real opening for progressive and left-wing alternatives. I see this as a moment in which a left that can think creatively about the challenges of the 21st century and not be tied to past dogmas and past formulas, but can really think creatively, can perhaps begin to speak and act on a much larger scale than we've been used to for quite some time.
And that was David McNally, professor of political science at York University in Toronto and the author of a number of books, including Another World is Possible, Globalization and Anti-Capitalism.
You're listening to excerpts from the series Capitalism and Its Discontents, produced for Pacifica Radio by Eric Klein, Eddie Yuen, Ramsey Kanan, and Sasha Lilly. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. We'll continue with more from the series Capitalism and Its Discontents with a story on food shortages. After water, nothing is more important than food. Yet we will hear in the upcoming story how, as a result of speculation in food markets, farmers won't be able to afford to produce enough food next year. As far as I'm concerned, that is reason enough to call for the immediate abolition of capitalism. A system that can't even assure that people can eat is worse than worthless, as well as totally immoral.
So rolls a riot van and sparks excitement in the boys. But the policemen look annoyed. Perhaps these are ones they should avoid. Got a chase last night from men with truncheons dressed in hats. I didn't do that much wrong, still ran away though for the laugh.
According to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, nearly 1 billion of the world's 6.5 billion people currently suffer from malnutrition. Last year, food prices soared, leading to riots in 30 countries. Prices have since dropped, but are predicted to rise again. Eric Klein reports.
Last year, food riots occurred throughout the world, with poor people taking to the streets to protest drastic increases in the price of basic foodstuffs. Eric Holtz-Jimenez, executive director of Food First, says last year's food crisis was a blip on the screen of what is actually a chronic food crisis globally. In 2008, inflation of basic commodity prices increased the number of hungry people in the world from around 850 million to closer to a billion people. Holtz-Jimenez says that the so-called food crisis was a precursor of sorts to the global financial crisis.
Well, the food crisis signaled the onset of the financial crisis in different ways. I mean, the first thing that the food crisis showed us was that the food system is tremendously volatile to both environmental and economic shock. And it's very volatile because it's controlled by just a few monopolies. And so tremendous concentration of power and wealth. And there's also just makes a lot of money over just a few crops and a few varieties within those crops. So very vulnerable to drought, to floods, to any sort of climatic variability. And because the food system is so concentrated in so few hands, it also responds to any sort of economic shock. And what we saw, which links the food crisis very directly to the financial crisis, not that one caused the other, but that they both come from the same source, is the speculation involved. In other words, companies making money not by producing anything of real wealth, but by squeezing profits from products and things where wealth has already been created. So if food is grown, you can squeeze profits out of that far above what that food is worth on the market by speculating with that food financially.
Holtz-Jimenez says that farmers across the globe have been hit hard by the wide swings in commodity prices.
You had the price of corn, which went as high as $10 a bushel. Then everybody wanted to grow corn, of course, and took out very expensive loans to grow this corn because the prices of the inputs went up because Mosaic could charge those high prices.
Mosaic is a leading seller of fertilizer worldwide.
But when they took the corn to market, they then found that the price had dropped down to 8, to 6, to 4. We've got $3 a bushel corn now. So farmers are stuck with huge debts, which they're not going to be able to pay with the profits from their production because they bought high and now they have to sell low. And this is true worldwide. So farmers aren't going to be able to plant as much this coming year.
On top of that, farmers will have trouble getting loans this time around, for obvious reasons. Extreme climate events, both droughts and floods, are also impacting farming worldwide.
The food system has a huge hand in producing these events, because industrial agriculture is the largest greenhouse gas emitter by none, more so than the transportation sector. Because it's dependent on petroleum, and it's dependent on cutting down forests, especially for the agri-fuels.
For Capitalism and its Discontents, I'm Eric Klein.
publicly subsidized, privately profitable, the anthem of the upper tier, untouchable, focus a moment, not in approval, bury our heads in the bargains of these neo-colonials.
As longtime listeners are aware, I've played a number of speakers advocating the abandonment of markets and a return to a form of the ancient economic system under which we evolved, the gift economy.